The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a 100% deposit bonus. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
All right, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour in the Super Bowl Sunday night, the 7th of February. Our engineer Brian Graves is across the way. Got a tremendous show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the former guitarist and lead singer of Grand Funk Railroad, Mark Farner, will join us. Then we'll speak to former New York Knick and Heisman Trophy winner Charlie Ward. In the second half, we'll bring in the drummer from the Allman Brothers Band, the legendary Butch Trucks, will join us. And finally, we'll talk to the former defenseman from the Rangers and Islanders, Tom Pody, will be our guest. So sit back and relax. Enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. We've got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by and give us a look, and then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest is a former lead singer and lead guitarist of Grand Funk Railroad. He's a legendary figure in rock and roll. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Mark Farner. Mark, good evening.
Good evening, Bill. Good to be here with you, brother.
Great to have you. Great to have you, Mark. Now, looking back in the beginning, Mark, who were some of your early influences in music?
Well, guitar-wise, it was, you know, my king was Jimi Hendrix. He made the thing cry. He made it shout. He made it sing. And really revolutionized the way I thought.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, the great Jimi Hendrix. Now, some of the... Go ahead, Mark.
As well, I was going to say, as well as Steve Cropper with Booker T and the MGs. I'm talking about the rhythm king of all guitar players. That guy, he's awesome.
Wonderful. Well, you had some preliminary projects before Grand Funk, namely The Pack and some other bands. That's where you met Don Brewer and Mel Shacker, correct?
That's right.
Okay, and you guys were all, you all hailed from Flint, Michigan.
Yeah, well, Don was from Swartz Creek, which was a little suburb of Flint.
There's suburbs of Flint?
Yeah, man.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're coming up in the world.
Yeah, I got you. Now, I had read one time David Frick of Rolling Stone magazine once said, you can't talk about rock and roll in the 70s without talking about Grand Funk Railroad. How do you feel about that statement?
I like him.
Yeah.
I like what he had to say.
Sure.
You know, we sold out Shea Stadium faster than the Beatles because the people loved us. We didn't have top 40. I mean, that wasn't who Grand Funk was. We loved the people as well, and that showed in our music, and we had something going.
You did. Now, we'll talk about the Big Shea in a little bit, but most people want to know where you got the name Grand Funk Railroad.
Well, it's taken from an actual railway system that runs through Ontario, Michigan, and Ohio called the Grand Trunk and Western.
Aha.
Yeah. And just in 1959, one of their trains broadsided my father and a fellow fireman and killed them both instantly.
Oh,
I was 9 years old.
What a shame.
Yeah, but it was kind of, you know, it had to be the Grand Funk Railroad, which was a song that Terry Knight, our former manager, had written. He said, you guys should actually use the name of my song for your band. We said, what is it? And he told us. We went, yeah, that sounds cool. But we'll use it.
Exactly. And as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah.
Nice little play on words there. Grand Trunk Western Railroad and Grand Funk Railroad.
Yep.
We're speaking of the great Mark Farner tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, the band first achieved recognition, I believe it was at the 69 Atlanta Pop Festival. Then you were signed by Capitol Records. Is that true, Mark?
Yes, that was our first gig.
And pretty well received.
Oh, boy. And I just, you know, remember walking up those steps, because prior to getting up on the platform, when you're down on the ground and you're looking out, you just see, like, the first few rows because, you know, you can't see beyond that. You just hear that there's a massive energy out there. And then when I went up the steps and I looked out over that audience, I went, holy crap, dude. I had to pee so bad.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, they liked you so much, they invited you back for the next pop festival.
That's right. Yeah, they liked the association and the relationship we had with the crowd right off, and we did, too. I mean, there was people from every state in the union out there, and the word spread fast.
I can imagine, yeah. Now, Grand Funk, were they patterned after other power trios like Cream, Mark?
No, actually, we liked the sound of three-piece, which Cream was awesome, you know, and Hendrix, and, you know, and Led Zeppelin, some of the groups of that era, but we patterned ourselves after what we heard growing up, and that was R&B and Motown.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of nights we sat up and listened to AM radio. It would come in skip from Nashville, Tennessee, WLAC in Nashville, Tennessee. You'd listen to the Royal Crown Hairdressing Show and listen to Muddy Waters and listening to, you know, the old blues stuff. That is what came out of Grand Funk that wasn't there in the other bands.
Right.
We were resonating from Assembly Line Rock and Roll coming out of Flint, Michigan. That's back before the water went bad. We had good water then and good production. People were working. You know, guys had two cars and a boat, and they were in a new house. And, I mean, everything was good. And, you know, then the people stopped supporting that, the big three. And that's what happens. Man, look at Detroit now.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what happens when you stop supporting your country. That's really it, man. Yeah.
That's it. You're right, Mark. Now, the Grand Funk Band, they developed their own personal style, as you said. The first album was titled On Time, sold over 1 million copies, and you got a gold record out of that.
Yeah. We got, that was On Time, but we were famed because the clock on the cover of that album, you know, that's back when they were LPs, it was backwards. The numbers were backwards on it. So, you know, that was kind of a clock that played into the whole on-time thing. But it's funny now because since I got my pacemaker, dude, I'm always on time.
I hear you. You got to be. Yeah, I know. Oh, boy. In February 70, the second album, Grand Funk, people call that the Red Album. That was went gold as well. And the group's first six albums, 5 studio, 1 live, pretty successful. Right, Mark?
Yes. Yeah, the people were loving the sound, and we were evolving as a band. You know, when I started playing in Grand Funk, Bill, I had just switched from bass guitar because I was playing with Terry Knight and the Pack and playing bass.
Uh-huh.
And before that, I was playing rhythm guitar in The Boss when with Dick Wagner, God rest his soul, from Alice Cooper's band, the guitar player from Alice Cooper's band.
Okay, well, you wrote the great hit I'm Your Captain, Closer to Home, from that album, Closer to Home. Stylistically, it was like Terry Knight's recordings. Talk a little bit about Closer to Home, Mark.
Well, Closer to Home actually was an answer to prayer, Bill. I went to sleep and went to bed that night, and my mother taught us six kids to pray, you know, now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take these things I ask in Jesus' sake, and then go on to pray, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I put a P.S. after I blessed all everybody I could remember in the family and, you know, went through my list. And then I put a P.S. on it, and I said, God, would you give me a song that would reach and touch the hearts of people you want to get to? And that song was written in the middle of the night. I'm always writing, not necessarily songs, but I write down everything and or record it that comes across my mind that's inspirational.
Uh-huh.
So it didn't dawn on me that it was a song until the following morning when I had my coffee on the table, I had my flat top, George Washburn, American Made Washburn, and playing and looking at the horses out in the pasture, man, and I just started playing that bum 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 dum, you know, the guitar lick.
Uh-huh.
And then the chords that came, I'd never played that succession of chords in that manner and didn't know that that you could play that C with the B string pressed down next to the E string there at the third position. And it rings a nice harmonic when you play the C that way instead of the standard way. Mm-hmm. So that was unique under that song, and it gave it this kind of a droning thing. And the guy that wrote the orchestration, Tommy Baker, he was the band leader on the Upbeat show out of Cleveland, Ohio, that was in Michigan and Indiana, and Illinois, Ohio. You know, they were kind of syndicated around. And that is where Tommy came up with this. He says, man, I hear these horns in there, I hear these strings. And he said, just make that thing go on forever when you guys come to the end. So we did.
Yeah.
We wore that thing out. It was, I think, 9 minutes and something, you know. And I used to get a lot of thank yous and, you know, appreciation for that song when we would go visit stations, and the guys would tell me, man, I love it because I can take a leak, I can have a cigarette, you know, I can do everything I need to do and come back. I'm not rushed. You know?
Yeah, just throw on I'm Your Captain and let it happen. Yeah, beautiful. Now, we spoke earlier, Mark, about Shea Stadium, the home, the former home of my favorite New York Mets. You equaled the attendance of the Beatles, but the thing is, as we said, you sold out Shea Stadium in 72 hours, and the Beatles, those guys, they took a couple of weeks to sell it out.
Yeah.
Not too bad.
Not too shabby for a garage band out of Flint, Michigan.
Yeah. Now you had a couple more albums. The live album came out in 70. Survival and E Pluribus Funk were both released in 71. And E Pluribus Funk celebrated the Shea Stadium show, didn't it?
Yes.
And it had I'll have to look for this. See if I have a copy, or if somebody has a copy around. The embossed depiction of Shea Stadium on the cover's reverse side.
Yeah.
Pretty unique.
That particular album, the E Pluribus, was done with a guitar that I had bought from Stevie Marriott, who brought it with them because they came from Europe and opened for us at Shea Stadium. We had those guys as an opening act for our European tour, which we had just got back from, you know, like a month earlier. And we told our manager back then, Terry, said, let's get those guys to open our U.S. tour, man. They mm-hmm. really rock. And so it was great to see them when I flew over the stadium in a helicopter, and I looked down, Humble Pies on stage, set up at second base, and that place, dude, it was rocking. It was rocking.
Yeah, well, that was a big ballpark back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Shea Stadium, 55,000 seats, sure was.
Yeah.
Now, by 71, you had a little trouble with Terry Knight.
Yeah, we found out some things that just kind of flipped our opinion on him.
Yeah.
Didn't know that things were happening, and then we found out later, you know, We're 20 years old. We my mother had to sign that contract for me, Bill.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
Just young kids and didn't know. I mean, if he'd have said to me, concerning my publishing, do you want all your money or half of it?
Yeah.
You know, if he'd have just been right up front and said that to me. But he said, well, you could publish your songs through my company. I didn't know about a publishing company. I'd never heard of this before, you know. So he's telling me what I need to do, and he's providing all the answers for the quiz. And as I recall back. But, you know, I let that go. That could have ate my lunch, you know. That's my power. I'm not going to waste it on, you know, hating somebody or holding, begrudging something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah, good you point, know? Mark.
Yeah, I had to let that stuff go. And just the same way that happens with the other guys that are going out and masquerading as Grant Funk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't tell anybody that the guy that wrote and sang over 90% of that music is no longer in the band and is not going to be there. You know, this is dishonest as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I understand.
But, and you know, just they could have said Grant Funk Revisited, you know.
Like Creedence did.
Yeah. Man,
yeah.
You know, to give a heads up, a
yep.
little clue anyways. But they're it's deception, and it's in the world, and it's even in rock and roll, and I hate it, but it's there.
It is. Mark Farn is with us tonight, Sports Talk 1240. Now, in 72, you bring Craig Frost in on keyboards full-time. You tried to get Peter Frampton in the band, I read.
Well, actually, we had talked about it, but Peter had already got his career off. He was onto something else. You know, somebody had snagged him and took him on his way. But Craig Frost was the guy that was in the pack with us.
Aha, uh-huh, okay.
So it was a perfect fit.
Yeah. Now,
you know, we knew each other as far as the feel for the music. I could anticipate what Craig was doing and vice versa, and with Mel, it made a good band.
Right.
But I was not for it.
Okay.
I voted against it because I thought the three-piece sound was part of our identity.
Right.
And
you always went along with that.
The other guys didn't see it that way. But I know now that it was because Brewer was not being satisfied with enough songwriting, and when Craig came into the band, Brewer and Craig would write music because the songs that Brewer wrote before Craig getting in the band were always songs that were extra tunes that I had no lyrics for yet, and he'd say, "Hey, have you got lyrics for that yet?" And I go, "No. Can I try it?" I go, "Yeah, man, try it." You know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where Shine and On came from. It came anything that was co-authored Brewer Farner, that's how it happened.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And Brewer came to me and told me, "I've never had 100% write credit on any song. Would you mind if I take it on American Band?" And I went, "No, go ahead. You know, I'd be
yeah.
a nice guy. I was just being a nice guy." But then, you know, when the road manager comes to me and says, after it's a hit, he says, "Don would like half of your royalties for the song that's on the B-side because, you know, I mean, that's just how it was right then." And I figured out that money makes people funny.
Yeah,
you know,
you're right, Mark.
Camaraderie kind of went to the wayside, and that's how the band kind of, you know, fell apart. It was Don came into a rehearsal in 76, and he says, "I got to find something more stable to do with my life." And we went, "What?"
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not here to badmouth him. I just wanted people to know the circumstances. And I think the fans deserve to know the truth about things and without throwing any mud. I would like to put the band back together, brother, just to satisfy the fans that
mm-hmm.
love me. Man, one of you guys are going to, hey, I'm for it. I've been trying to get them to do it for years, but every one of the meetings that we've had, you know, shareholder meetings, they vote it down.
Well, American Band, I remember that album, the Gold album. Todd Rundgren produced it. Very successful. As you said, Brewer got the headline for writing that tune. What made you decide to do the Locomotion, Carole King's Locomotion?
Well, we were in the recording studio one day, which was right across the street from my farm. And I had 80 acres on that side of the road, and we built the studio way back in the corner, and it was a little swampy down there, so we called it the Swamp, respectfully.
Yeah.
And I was going back down to the Swamp, and it had like a snaking driveway. It didn't look right straight back there, so I'm walking along and singing, because the sun's out, dude. It is in the country. I'm walking down this dirt driveway, and the birds are chirping, and I started singing it.
Uh-huh.
And the guys, I didn't know it, but the guys were out having a smoke in the parking lot, and they heard me singing. They started singing the background. Come on, baby, do the locomotion,
Yeah.
And so Todd comes walking out, and he says, dudes, what is that? We said, what are you talking about? What is that? That's Little Eva. That's the locomotion.
Yeah.
And he says, man, whatever it is, we got to do it right now. Come on, let's everybody get in here right now and capture this because, the energy's right for this, and we made a party out of it.
Beautiful. What a great story that is, Mark. Mark Farn is with us tonight, Sports Talk 1240. You ran into some trouble with Capital. Things happen, as you say. Money is the root of all evil.
The love of it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Grand Funk found new life. Frank Zappa produced an album for you.
Yeah, Brother Frank. God rest his soul.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Zappa working with him.
Well, he came to Michigan, and the same way, when we picked Rundgren, we had a bunch of names in the hat, Bill, and just stirred it up and pulled one out. And this was people that we hadn't spoken with at all, but we just took a chance that if we picked somebody, they would, and it worked both times. So,
yeah.
So when we picked Zappa, we all kind of looked at each other and went, wow, okay, wonder if he'll come out here. So he came to Michigan, and he told us, when Craig Frost backed up against Brewer and farted on his leg, he said he knew right then that this band was for him.
Why not, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's push forward 1996 a little bit, Mark. The three members reunite. You play to 250,000 people in a great run of shows. The Bosnian benefit concerts. Paul Schaefer was with you from the David Letterman show.
Yeah.
Fill the folks in a little bit on that, Mark.
Well, that was a dream come true for the band because we had always envisioned one day doing I'm Your Captain with an orchestra.
Oh,
And Loneliness. And, Paul changed it up just enough to give it his little signature, which is great because he's got great musical feel. He's a rhythm funky guy,
Yeah.
And just the way he moves when he's, throwing that orchestra around. It's great to watch him. But that was our dream come true, and it was when the audience was singing, I'm getting closer, just like Shea Stadium. They drowned out the PA, dude. It's just from the heart.
Yeah.
And I've been so blessed, to have written that song and to be rewarded by the love for it, and especially with our soldiers because, man, when that song came out, Bill, they were in Vietnam in a foxhole someplace.
Right.
Crap flying over their head and all around. They wanted to be closer to home. And that was the song. And in 2005, was the 25th anniversary of the Vietnam Veterans Wall at D.C., and they asked me if I would come and play that song.
Ooh, boy.
Yeah, so I said, are you going to have a stage there? Or are you going to have any kind of thing to make your presentations. And he went, yeah, man. And I said, if you're going to have a stage and a PA, I will bring my band and we'll do a show for the vets. And we did, and it was great. It was 34 degrees, dude. We were warming our hands in the dressing room on the light bulbs.
Oh, man.
Yeah, but it was
what a wonderful. Great idea.
Yeah, it was a wonderful moment to look out and see Vietnam veterans from Canada and the United States standing there, bawling their face off and hugging each other. And, wow. Man.
I can imagine.
Pinch me. It was, you know, it's like goosebumps on your goosebumps. Paul Schaefer added just enough of that, you know, to make it not exactly like the same orchestration, but had the same key lines.
Yeah.
You know, and the flute playing the refrain and the strings and everything was beautiful, man.
Well, I always say, Mark, you're not anybody till you become a bobblehead doll or you're on The Simpsons. And you made it to The Simpsons.
Yeah. How about that?
Amazing. Now, for those who missed that episode, Homer's driving the kids in the car. Grand Funk Shining On comes on the radio. The kids don't like it, so they ask Homer to change the station. And he says, you kids don't like Grand Funk? The wild shirtless lyrics of Mark Farner? The bong-rattling bass of Mel Shacker, the competent drum work of Don Brewer. Ah, you made it, Mark.
That was great.
Yeah. Yep. Did they contact you about that? Did you know they were going to do that?
No, we did not have a clue. But we used it to open the show at Pine Knob in Detroit.
Oh, boy, that must have been great.
Yeah, we ran it on the big screens. And then we walked out. So it was good. It was really good.
And you even toured for a while with Ringo and some pretty good names. Randy Bachman, John Entwistle, the late John Entwistle, the late Billy Preston.
God rest his soul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some great guys there.
Great guys. But I'm going to tell you something. They put me right next to Brother John, and he was deafer than a post.
Ooh.
When he played, he had to play that thing really loud to hear it. And I'm talking, it would take away my equilibrium. It was so loud. And so I kept moving and stepping further away and further away. And finally, Ringo's turned around and he says, turn that damn thing down.
Yeah. Between him and Pete, I guess, yeah. Oh, boy. Not much hearing there.
No, but what a wonderful, beautiful human being John was. His memory in my heart. I mean, when we were praying one time before we went on, and it was hotter than the sheriff's pistol, man. It was like over on the lake in Wisconsin, and we were circled up and just said a little prayer, and we got that we were ready to go on stage, and John just stopped and he said, well, you could have said something about the weather.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Entwistle. Yeah, yeah, he's certainly missed. Well, I tell you, Mark, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking the time out of your Sunday night to be with us.
Brother Bill, it has been my honor, my pleasure. Thank you. Good to speak to you. God bless you. God bless the listeners. God bless our United States.
Thank you, Mark. Give my regards to your wife.
Thank you, Bill. I will.
Take care. Mark Farner, stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240 and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines, also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Phil Donahue with you on this Super Bowl Sunday. I hope you had a good weekend. More snow here on Long Island, and I guess there's more on the way. Super Bowl's at the halftime. For those of you, the few of you listening to the show, 13-7 is the score. Denver is up, and welcome to the annual Super Bowl show, and I thank you for joining us tonight. Well, my next guest is a founding member of the Allman Brothers Band. As such, he is a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. He's now working with his own freight train band. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Butch Trucks. Butch, good evening.
How are you?
Great to have you with us.
It's great to be with you. I was kind of surprised today when my manager said, we're going to do a sports talk show on Super Bowl Sunday, and I'm figuring, you think you got a big audience?
Well, you're the draw, Butch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I'd like to believe that. Okay.
We're going to kill. We're going to kill in the ratings. Don't worry. Now, let's talk about your early influences, Butch.
My early influences?
Yes. As a drummer.
Oh, as a drummer.
As a drummer or as a musician?
Well, as a musician, I started out in church. And,
okay.
You know, I had a beautiful boy soprano voice, so as an eight-year-old, I'd get up in front of church and sing I Believe and watch my mom cry all over the place and all that kind of stuff. music just came very, very naturally to me from the beginning. And then I got into classical music, and all the way through high school, I played with I wound up playing timpani. That's one reason I used timpani with the Allman Brothers,
uh-huh.
is because I was a timpanist in high school with the Florida All-State High School Symphony Orchestra timpanist, and actually got the job as a student conductor. I got to conduct the Dvorak New World Symphony as a 12th grader in high school, which was a very powerful moment,
Outstanding.
Have an orchestra at your control.
Yeah.
And then I went off to college and kind of got out of music because I did get into a rock and roll band in high school, picked up drums, started in the eighth grade with a marching band. And then it followed the usual, got a set of drums, learned how to play them, and then got into a rock and roll band. But about the time I went off to college, 1966, there was really nothing going on. It was the Beatles were just had just come out with, and their first two albums to me were just, refurbished Chuck Berry.
Ah, okay, and, interesting.
Yeah, and then I got off to college. I went off to Florida State University, and the Byrds came out, and I started listening to the Byrds and Bob Dylan and Lovin' Spoonful, and got in this three-piece group, and that's what we played. And then the Beatles did Rubber Soul, and all of a sudden, the music, rock and roll became more than just three chords and more than just, it got very serious. It got much more sophisticated.
Right. The Chuck Berry stuff was out the window for the Beatles then.
It's still, Chuck Berry is great, and that's all fun and everything, but as a musician, it's not all that challenging,
Right.
And so, as it got more and more sophisticated, I liked it, because that's mm-hmm. coming from that classical background. I was trained and, I knew my technique and in fact, I was the only member of the original Allman Brothers Band that could read and write music. And it was kind of funny. So
sure. Now, Butch, the 31st of February band.
That was the bitter end.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, we put out an album with Vanguard Records, and the Bitter End Club in New York wouldn't let us use the name the Bitter End, so we had to come up with a name really fast. And our bass player came up with the 31st of February, and I thought it was dumb. And I still do, but whatever.
Yeah.
In fact, we wound up being called the Allman Brothers because we couldn't think of anything else.
That's what I had read in my research, yeah, which is that's a pretty good story in itself, though.
Well, it was Dwayne's band. I mean, Dwayne started it. He came to Jacksonville, and, everybody wanted to be in his band. And I had played with he and Greg. They joined up with the 31st of February. And in fact, that album that's out that's called Dwayne and Greg Allman was supposed to be the second album for the 31st of February.
Ah.
And they were still under contract to Liberty Records out in L.A., so we put Dwayne on there as a sideman. And Greg's vocals, that was the first time he ever recorded Melissa. But he was just laying down a pilot track for Scott Boyer, who was our singer, to sing the song. And then the whole thing fell apart, and these crooks down in Miami, once the Allman Brothers hit real big, they took the cover, they took the picture
yeah.
off of Idlewild South.
Oh.
And put it on the cover and call the damn album Dwayne and Greg Allman. And so,
anything for a buck, yeah.
You got it.
Yeah.
You got it. It's the music business. It's the rule. It's not the exception.
Between you and J-Mo, though, two different styles. You were more of a powerful conventional beat. And J-Mo was more of a jazz influence guy. As I think it was Dickie Betts who gave you the Freight Train moniker and talked about your meat and potatoes type drumming. Talk a little bit about the two styles, Butch, between you and J-Mo.
Yeah, it's not something that we ever talked about.
Okay,
and it's something that from the very beginning it just worked. And it's not, I've never worked with another drummer that where it just, the two styles meshed so well, And the only problem that we had was with the bass drums getting in the way. So the way we solved that is J-Mo would play an 18-inch bass drum and not muffle it. So my bass drum would be the poof, poof, poof that drive the band. And his bass drum was more like a big tom-tom.
Uh-huh.
So that was really the only conflict that we would have. But our styles, because my background was, coming from rock and roll, and his was jazz. And not only did that, make our are make us able to play together without getting in each other's way. In fact, complimenting each other.
Mm-hmm.
J-Mo is the one who turned us all on to John Coltrane and Miles Davis and Chick Corea and Charlie Parker and, you know, all of that. And that's, I think, you know, that's what made the Allman Brothers something special.
Well, the styles melded, Butch, on the drums, sort of like the guitars melded together, the two lead guitars.
Yeah, yeah, and it's also the way that we play, you know, because we would come in, Cream kind of opened the door to improvising in rock and roll, but they came from a blues, you know,
right.
From a blues background. It's strictly blues. And so their jams tended to be pretty monodynamic and would be one chord, and, you know, but they did open the door to improvising. And we picked it up from there, and then once J-Mo turned us on to jazz, and we started thinking, hey, wait a minute. We started jamming. We don't have to stay in one chord. In fact, we can start out quiet and build it up and then change keys and even change time signatures and just do whatever, you know?
Yeah.
When you're improvising, that's really what you should be doing. And, you know, so, you know, we'd get up and, you know, every night, it's one way that you can play the same song for 45 years and it still has intensity and it's still fun because every night it's different.
Exactly. What a great
point.
You
never do it the same way twice.
What a great point, yeah. And you guys also, you realize that the audience was a big part of what you did. And that couldn't be duplicated in the studio. So you went and did Fillmore East.
Yep, yeah, exactly. But let's kind of back up here.
Go ahead.
The first thing that we realized is because we took our brand of music out on the road and nobody had really heard it before. So our first couple of times around the country, it wasn't an overwhelming success. You know, I remember the one night, this is a real good example. We opened for Iggy Pop in Detroit. And we got up there and played our brand of music, and you can imagine what Iggy Pop's audience thought of that. I mean, I don't think they had any idea what to think. They basically just stood there and went, what the hell?
Yeah.
So I mean, what we learned is, and it is still to this day, if you're playing music and if you're really focused on playing music, it is completely selfish. You're doing it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I play to make myself feel good. And that's where it starts. And then you get with people that you can communicate with, and you find people that have that same approach to music, and then we start communicating with each other, and then that really explodes, and then eventually the audience picks up on it. But you know, if you're up there to play to the audience, then you're entertaining,
right?
You know, music is a very selfish thing. You've got to do it to make yourself feel good, and that. And you know, then it's honest, and once the audience gets in and they start adding that energy, then you can get things like the Fillmore East or the next to the last night we closed the Fillmore East,
uh-huh.
And the night before closing night, we went on stage at 1 o'clock in the morning and finished at 8 o'clock the next morning. We went 7 hours straight.
Not too shabby.
It was just unbelievable, you know. And it's not, you can't do that without, you know, bringing the crowd into what you're doing. You get a loop going where you get the energy going and then they feed it back and then you throw it back and then they feed it back and it just, and you can just go places that you could never go, you know, just sitting in a practice room.
Yeah, it spills
and,
over.
And that's one reason we decided to do a live album because, you know, in a studio, you have to play a lot simpler. you can't really let loose, and you have to be much more careful, and you don't have the energy of the crowd.
Right. Now, you had a great relationship with Dwayne, we know. People may not realize that the extent you guys were into literature and philosophy and the viewpoints that you shared. Talk a little bit about that for us, Butch.
Wow. Well, Dwayne.
This should take us up to the end, right?
Yeah, Dwayne was a very. He's the most intense human being I've ever known. If I had met Dwayne Allman, I'd probably be a math teacher. Because, you know, the one thing that Dwayne taught me, and I really don't have time to tell the whole story, but, I mean, it was before he invited me into the Allman Brothers, he had to make sure that I had the confidence to do it, because up until this particular moment, I was kind of introverted, and if the music wasn't really going, I would tend to think, oh, everybody's looking at me, and I'd pull back. And, you know, J-Mo kept telling him, hey, Butch is a guy you want in the band, but, you know, Dwayne had played with me before, and he knew I had that flaw. And so one day we're jamming, and I did that, and he turned around and played this lick, and it was like, come on, damn it. And my first reaction was to back up. And he did it again. And he did it again. And you know, there's hundreds of people looking at him showing me up. And so I got mad. And I started hitting the drums like I was hitting him. And he started hitting back at me, and I was hitting at him. And then he backed up and smiled and went, there you go.
Yeah.
And then it's like he reached inside and flicked a switch. Because the music was soaring. And this light bulb went off. I said, Butch, you can play. I mean, quit, you know, just let it go. I mean, you may not be the greatest drummer in the world, but you can play. And always give it everything you got. And from that moment to this, that's the way I do it. That's the way I approach, and that's probably when they call me the freight train.
And it keeps rolling, that's for sure.
But now, Dwayne dropped out of high school in the 10th grade.
Okay.
And he was better educated than almost any college graduate that I know. He taught himself algebra.
I couldn't even learn that from somebody else.
No. Come on. I mean, you know, Dwayne figured it out sitting in a schoolroom, you know, listening to some teacher that he was probably five times smarter than, and he said, yeah, I don't need to sit here and listen to this. I just get the books and teach myself. So he did. And he and I were both avid readers. And you know, I was just starting to scratch the surface with philosophy, but I was really, knee-deep into Tolkien.
Okay.
Yeah, so I turned Dwayne on to that, and his daughter's name is Galadriel.
You know? Right.
So we used to go fishing all the time, and we'd pull into a town and have an afternoon off. He and I'd go find a lake somewhere and just buy a couple of cheap rod and reels and just sit on a bank and talk about books. And we went through Tolkien, and then he read somewhere that Friedrich Nietzsche, made the comment or said that life without music wouldn't be worth living. He said, anybody will say that. I want to know what else he has to say. So we dove right into all of those Sprach Zarathustra, and trust me, that was a very deep dive. And it was really good, because we would sit there and talk for a couple of hours. And he'd pick up on things that I wouldn't get. I'd pick up on things that he wouldn't get. So we helped each other through some stuff that we probably couldn't have gotten through by ourselves. And so we got through Nietzsche and then went to John Locke and then to Rousseau. And that's what we were in the middle of when he was killed. And
what a great story.
I think Rousseau is still my favorite, and, you know, I guess Rousseau if all the hippies out there knew it, he was definitely a philosopher of the hippies.
Well, what a good story about Duane Allman. Well, we've got Butch Trucks with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, after Duane's death, we lost Duane. Another album comes out. You guys realize that you have to keep going on without Duane. Eat a Peach.
Yeah, well, that was a tough. I mean, I don't know. You've kind of gotten a little bit about what kind of man he was and the influence he had on people. I mean, if you were lucky enough to know him, he changed you, and it was for the better. I mean, Duane was, to get a little literary again, he was like Goethe's Faust.
Okay.
You know, he wanted to experience everything life had to offer, but his focus, he had a laser focus on music. Now, you know, but he didn't, you don't play music 24/7. You know, you've got other parts of life. There's other things going on. And Duane experimented with everything. When I met him, he was taking Black Beauty's methadrine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he played around with it for a while. And as soon as he realized it was messing with his music, he stopped and never touched him again. And, you know, that's the way he was. He would try everything, you know. And as soon as he realized that it was messing with his music, then that would be put away. And those things that would help him out or, you know, teach him or that felt good and wouldn't harm him or hurt his music, that he would keep. And, you know, he was just an incredible, incredible human being. And when he died, and, I mean, he was our leader, but he didn't demand it. You know, he put together a band, and he let everybody have their own voice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was everyone knew that he was a leader, but he didn't act like it. You know, he just, you know, if something had to be done with management or something like that, he'd take care of it. But, you know, when it came to the music, you know, it was a band of equals. And it was one reason. I mean, he really fought the whole calling it the Allman Brothers Band. He said, you know, it's maybe I put this band together, but this is a band of equals, and I don't want it to be named after me.
Uh-huh.
And it was our manager who finally, we just couldn't come up with anything else. Believe it or not, the first gig we ever played, we called ourselves Beelzebub.
I had read something about that name coming up in the choices, Butch. Yeah.
Yep. That was it.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was a good choice. and I think once Wayne thought about it, he didn't either. So, you know, but we just couldn't come up with anything else. And, you know, we had the first album ready to go. We had all this music ready to go, and we had to have a name. And our manager kept pounding away saying, you know, Wayne, people know who he was. I mean, by that time, he'd already done, you know, the Men Out Hall, you know, Wilson Pickett's Hey Dude and Aretha Franklin. And it did tons and tons of stuff coming out of Muscle Shoals. So, you know, he had a reputation, and our manager just wanted to use his name to try to help us get started. And like I said, we couldn't come up with anything else. And so we called ourselves the Allman Brothers Band, but we didn't think that Duane was going to die and leave us with his brother. So, but he did. And we kept going. We just couldn't stop. We just couldn't, you know.
Well, that was a great
legacy.
It
was as much a tribute to Duane as anything else, you know. Because we talked about it. You say, you know, This is Duane's band. Can we really keep going? And then we just came to the conclusion that there's nothing else we can do. We have to. We can't let this go. It's too good. It's too new, and it's too intense, and it was still so powerful. And even though Duane wasn't up there, and we took a little turn from the direction where we were headed that, you know, wound up kind of, it's kind of one of the main reasons that we broke up in 76. But we kind of lost track of, you know, the music and where we were going, and became rock stars and got completely out of control. But
You took up residency at the Beacon after a while. For a little bit. Yeah, a couple of dates there. What did that mean to the band, coming back to the Beacon every March, every year?
Oh, I miss it. God, I miss it. I really do. I mean, it was 25 years, 357 sellouts in a row.
Amazing.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's ever going to beat that one.
No, I think Jerry Seinfeld's trying to do it, Butch. Yeah, he's set himself up at the Beacon now for 12 months out of the year. We'll see what he does, but he won't come
Who's
close.
That?
Jerry Seinfeld.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the comedian.
Yeah, but he's doing one show at a time.
That's
right?
It. Yeah, he's got nowhere near the chops that the A-Bros do. Are you sorry that you didn't do a final studio album, Butch?
No.
Okay.
No, and I keep reading it from Derek and Warren and all that about how, you know, but I mean, the bottom line is, you know, especially coming from Derek, I'm going, where's he coming from? Because the last 5-10 years that he was in the Allman Brothers, it was all we could do to get 30-40 shows a year out of him. He was putting most of his energy into what he was doing and not the Allman Brothers. So I don't know where the hell he, I mean, it takes a lot of time to put together a record. I mean, you got to write all the material, then you have to learn everything well enough to where, you know, you can play it like you know how to play it, and then you have to spend several $100,000 making the damn thing, and they don't sell anymore.
Right.
And it's, like I say, it's not all that much fun, and so...
Good point.
No, I wish that we would have had more new songs toward the end, because... You know, as things were winding down, Greg started going in his own direction. Warren and Derek had their own bands, and they were writing more. They were writing the tunes for their stuff, not for the Allman Brothers. So, you know, I would have liked more new material, but, you know, we didn't get it. And so we got... Pretty good. We had a pretty good 45-year run.
I would say, yeah. Now, here comes the sports, Butch. You ready for this?
Okay.
Virgil Fire Trucks. People don't know that the great Virgil Trucks is the uncle to the legendary Butch Trucks.
No, he's not my uncle.
He's not?
Nope. We traced it down, and I'm not quite sure. I guess he'd be like a third cousin or something.
All right.
My great grandfather was his great great grandfather's brother.
Okay, think about that one, folks.
It's the other way around.
Okay,
his great grandfather was my great great grandfather's brother. That's what it was. Yes.
All right.
So we're related, but
not as close as everybody thinks. Okay.
No.
Now let's get to the Freight Train Band. You got your son in there, Valor, Barry Oakley Jr., a legacy. Heather Gillis looks to be a great talent. You're back in Charleston coming up, and then I guess you're back in France. So give us a little rundown on the Freight Train.
Well, you kind of hit it there. I bought a place over in France. I bought an old the foundation is actually Roman, which makes it at least third century.
Wow.
And the room where I sit and practice, and I've got a 7.1 surround sound sound system and my computer and everything, that's kind of new. It's from the 12th century.
Yeah, no.
The room I'm sitting in was like 400 years old when Columbus landed here.
Oh, that's much. Oh, some setup.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I my wife and I went over last May and stayed, and after about, you know, I hadn't played since last October when we finished the Allman Brothers, and I just reached the point. I've got to play.
Yeah.
And I came over and played with somebody of mine from West Palm Beach. My wife and I have a condo there. And then I got a call from Barry, and he said, "Hey, you want to get something started?" I went, "Hell yeah!"
Yeah.
So we got us a manager, and Barry was playing with us. Damon Fowler, who's the other guitar player with the Freight Train, who's a smoking guitar player. And I had just gone to Tallahassee with that band that I went over. It's one of the places I played when I came back over. I went back to Tallahassee where I lived for 16 years and played this funky club. And somebody comes up and taps me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, there's this girl here that she wants to sit in, and she's very good." And up came this gorgeous 20-year-old girl, and my first reaction is, "Boy, this girl suck," you know? Because most beautiful women I've known never really took the time to really work at anything. I mean, it's kind of...
They don't have to. Born, yeah.
It's like being born a billionaire. Why work, you know?
Yeah.
You don't have to. So... She got up and she started singing that old Bill Withers song, "Ain't No Sunshine."
Ain't No Sunshine, yeah.
And then she started playing the damn guitar, and I mean, she blew me away. And she is now a full fledged member of the Freight Train band. Her name's Heather Gillis, and so
yeah.
You got my 68-year-old bun up there, and she just turned 21, and we got everything in between.
Well, that's great.
My son Valor and Damon and Bruce Katz playing keyboards, and I got an old buddy named Tad Ish that plays on some of the Allman Brothers tunes. You kind of have to have two sets of drums, so he helps me out with the drums, and then he'll play on a few of the songs. But we do like four or five Allman Brothers songs tonight. I don't want this to be an Allman Brothers cover band.
Right.
But I insist that we keep that same freedom, that same level of intensity and freedom where, you know, we can improvise and where we're not up there doing the same damn thing every night, you know.
Right.
And everybody in the band has the same attitude, and we're having a ball.
Outstanding.
I mean, we're having a ball. We've only played 13 or 14 shows. And if you want to go on to Facebook, go to my page. Just go to Butch Trucks go to the Facebook page.
Okay.
And there is a full concert that we did last week.
Oh, we'll have to check that out.
It was only the second show of this run, so it's a little bit rusty, but you'll see everybody, and you can feel the intensity.
Great. Well, I tell you, Butch, it's been a pleasure. It's been an honor having you with us tonight. I really appreciate you taking time out of your Super Bowl Sunday night to be with us.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm not a pro football fan. I'm Florida State Seminole, died in the wool. I mean, I just bleed garnet and gold, and I don't know. Once I used to like the NFL when I was a kid, but once free agency came along, it just wasn't the same anymore.
No.
You know? You're pulling for these guys one year, and the next year you hate them, and you're supposed to like the guys you hated the year before, and it just, you know.
You're just rooting for a uniform.
Yeah, you got it. You got it. But at Florida State, I mean, they have the misfortune of getting really good players, so they don't stick around more than about 2 years. But at least they don't go to another college.
Right. You know? Great. Well, thanks for being with us, Butch.
All right. Thank you.
Thank Doug for putting it together, too.
Uh, right. We hope to be up there pretty soon.
Great. We'll look for you, Butch. Take care. Butch Trucks, ladies and gentlemen.
Right, bye-bye.
Up next, we'll talk to the defenseman from the Rangers and the Islanders, Tom Pote, on Sports Talk 1240. Stick around, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines, also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, welcome back to Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through this Super Bowl Sunday evening. Hope you're enjoying the show. Hope you had a good weekend, and I hope you're ready for some more snow, because it's on the way. Not that we need it. Well, our next guest played 14 seasons in the NHL, most notably for us on the blue line with the Rangers and the Islanders. Going to welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Tom Pote. Tom, good evening.
How you doing, guys?
Great to have you with us, Tom.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
You grew up in Massachusetts. Who were your favorite teams and players when you were a kid?
Basically, I always liked all the guys in the Bruins. I rooted for Ray Bourque and Cam Neely, guys like that. And then, in a bit of a twist, I was always a Yankees fan growing up. I never liked the hometown Red Sox.
Wow. Yankee
fan, so.
Yeah. That's a switch, yeah. Now, you were drafted in the third round of this 96 NHL entry draft, 59th by the Edmonton Oilers. How'd you feel about going to Edmonton?
I wasn't too crazy about it.
Okay.
I think sitting in the stands, you're kind of hoping that you would be able to get drafted a little bit closer to home. And obviously Edmonton was probably the furthest possible place away for me to get drafted. But at the end of the day, it worked out really good for me. And I loved playing up in Edmonton, and we had a really good group of guys, and it was an easy transition for me coming from college.
You had some guys on Edmonton who certainly spent some quality time in New York. You had Guerin, Doug Waite, Roman Hammerlick. Talk a little bit about those guys, Yanni Nenema.
Yeah, those are all great guys. You know, Billy Guerin and Dougie Waite were two close friends of mine up there. And, you know, being American guys, they kind of took me under their wing. And, you know, it was nice to be able to play with those guys. And, you know, playing with Roman Hammerlick, too, he was my defensive partner for 2 or 3 years up there.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's great to be able to learn under a guy like that.
Yeah, great hockey player, Islander. On 2003, Tom, you come to the Rangers in exchange for Mike York and a draft choice. How did you feel about coming to New York?
I was excited. Obviously, it was super close to home, and I was kind of excited to get a fresh start moving on from Edmonton, and you know, I was happy to be so close to home and playing for New York and the Rangers.
Well, we're talking to Tom Pote tonight on Sports Talk 1240. You were the point man on the power play.
I was, yep, for a little while.
Yeah, and how did you enjoy that?
I loved that. It was great. My first year there, I was kind of the go-to guy, and I put up just almost 50 points and had a great first season in New York, and I ended up playing in the All-Star game, so that was pretty cool, a lot of fun.
Definitely. Now, you played with some Hall of Fame caliber hockey players on the Rangers. Let's talk about some of those guys and get your opinion. Let's start with Richter.
Mike Richter was a great guy. He was super friendly to me, kind of helped me out a lot when I got traded to New York, and you know, it was great playing under him, and you know, I can't say enough good things about Brian Leetch and also Mark Messier as well.
Right, that's who I was going to bring up, those guys as well. Now, there was a coaching change when you were on the Rangers, Tom. Of all people, they bring in Brian Trottier to coach the Rangers. Now, he didn't have much success. How was Trotz as a head coach?
I actually liked him. I got along really good with him, and I guess he kind of fell out of favor a little bit. We weren't really doing that well. We weren't winning. We had a huge payroll, high payroll team, and I think they just wanted to shake things up, but you know, I got nothing but good things to say about Trotz, and you know, I enjoyed having him as a coach for that little while.
Outstanding. Okay, and didn't you play with Lundqvist for a season?
I did. I played with Lundqvist for two seasons.
Two. Okay.
Yep.
And could you see the brilliance there yet?
Oh, definitely. I think my second year in New York was his rookie year. And he came in as the backup to Kevin Weeks. And you could just tell he was going to be a special player and kind of be in the league for a long time. He had such great reflexes, and you know, he saw the puck no matter where it was, and you know, his angles were unbelievable. And you could just tell he was going to be a great goalie for a long time. And obviously he's still doing his thing and doing awesome.
Still chugging. Yeah, he certainly is. Tom Pote's with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. 2006-07, you signed with the Islanders. What made you pick the Islanders, Tom?
I'm not sure. I think they had offered me a really good contract and a good package, and I liked at the time Neil Smith had signed, so I was excited to go and play for him. I had met him a few times and I'd known him a little bit, and they kind of put a nice little package together for me there. Towards my end of my years with the Rangers, they weren't really using me on the power play and stuff anymore, and they kind of said, you know, you come to the Islanders and you can be our power play guy, and I was just excited about going over there to play.
Right, you played for Ted Nolan, a guy who probably didn't get a great shake with the Islanders. Jason Blake was on that club, Miro Chatan, Mike Sillinger, guys like that the fans may remember. Then you moved on to...
Yeah, Alexi Yashin was on that team too, yep.
Well, yeah, the folks may not want to remember Alexei. Yeah, I think he's out there somewhere practicing getting ridden off the puck. You signed a 4-year deal with the Caps coming away from the Islanders. Seemed like a good deal. You won your first playoff series with the Caps, and they beat the Rangers that go round. That must have been pretty sweet.
Yeah, it was nice. Anytime you kind of face your former team, it's always nice to beat them, and honestly, and playing against them in the playoffs and winning the series against them is always special. And I had a great career with the Caps, and you know, I think it was probably one of the best stops I had. I was there for almost 6 years and met a lot of great people, and enjoyed my time there as well.
Yeah, unfortunately, a groin injury ended your stay there, and you retired. Now, let's talk about some of the guys that you played with there, and they're still going, Alex Ovechkin and Mr. Backstrom.
Yeah, those are obviously two very special players. I think both of them will ultimately end up in the Hall of Fame someday. Obviously, Ovi definitely will. I'm sure Backstrom will, too. And, you know, those guys were, a lot of fun to play with when I was, obviously, towards the end of my career. They were kind of just starting out in their career, and it was just fun to watch their youth and their energy and their love for the game.
Oh, there's certainly a thorn in the Islanders' side, I'll tell you that, Tom. Especially
right, yeah.
after the playoff series last spring. Now,
I watched a few of those games.
Oh, now you played for the Hershey Bears. I saw. Now, we're familiar with the Hershey Bears from, of course, the Giant Center down there on the grounds of Hershey Park.
Yep.
How was it setting yourself up in Hershey, Pennsylvania, of all places?
That was a different experience.
Yeah.
It was the first time I'd ever played in the AHL. It was a pretty cool experience, actually. I had missed about a year and a half with injury. I had a fractured pelvis, and I was just coming back. I showed up at training camp, and I kind of wanted to get some games in under my belt, not just practices. So they let me go down there to play a little bit of hockey, and my first game was in Hershey at the Giant Center there. And then the second game I played was actually in Worcester, which is my hometown.
Oh, nice.
Sharks. So I got two games under my belt, and I was able to get called back up to the Caps and finish that that shortened lockout season.
Outstanding. Now, you won silver in 2002 in Salt Lake City with the U.S. That had to be a great thrill for you, Tom.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was one of my most fondest memories as a hockey player. Being able to play with all those great players in that Olympics, and obviously to be able to play for Herb Brooks, too, was pretty special.
What a thrill, the great Herb Brooks. Who were your toughest opponents and your best teammates along the way, Tom?
Probably my best teammates. I think, like I said, when in Edmonton, I really enjoyed playing with Dougie Waite and Billy Guerin.
Mm-hmm.
Really liked playing with Mike Greer up there. And then the Rangers, I enjoyed playing with Leachy and Mess. And Eric Lindros was a great guy, too. Got along well with him.
Eric Lindros, yeah.
In Washington, I was able to play with a couple guys. Brian Poffier was a local guy that I was able to play with. I grew up playing with him, youth hockey and stuff. So, and a good friend of mine, Dan Lacature, who we lived on the Cape together in the same town, played a couple different teams with him. So I was able to kind of be able to play with some of my friends from youth hockey and meet a lot of great guys along the way as well.
What are you doing these days, Tom?
Still involved in hockey. I'm actually, my friend Dan Lacature that I just mentioned, we have a little youth hockey team down here that we coach down on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and we're having fun coaching the kids and helping them enjoy the game.
Outstanding. Well, Tom, I tell you, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night, out of your Super Bowl, to be with us.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
You take care, Tom. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks. Bye now.
Tom Fogarty, folks. Okay, what we're going to do now is take a look at the Hall of Famers who were elected this weekend before the Super Bowl. The class of 2016, we have eight inductees into the Canton Hall of Fame. We'll start off with Tony Dungy. Tony Dungy, the coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the Minnesota Vikings, and the Indianapolis Colts for 13 seasons. He was an assistant with the Pittsburgh Steelers, the Kansas City Chiefs, and the Minnesota Vikings. He took over the Bucs team in 1996. They suffered 12 double-digit loss seasons in the previous 13 years. By his second season, the team finished 10-6 and earned a playoff berth. Two seasons later, in 1999, the Bucs posted an 11-5 record and clinched the franchise's first divisional title since 1981. After six seasons in Tampa Bay that included four trips to the playoffs, Dungy was relieved of his duties 8 days after dismissal. He was hired by the Indianapolis Colts. During his 7 years as Indy's head coach, the Colts posted 12 or more wins in every season except his first, when they finished 10-6. Indianapolis claimed five divisional titles, advanced to the playoffs every year of Tony Dungy's tenure. He guided the Colts to the AFC South Division title in 2006 and capped the season with a win over the New England Patriots in the AFC Championship game and a victory over the Chicago Bears in Super Bowl. I don't know the Greek letter. I'm sorry. The first American head coach ever to win a Super Bowl. Overall record as head coach, an astounding 148-79. Posted a .668 winning percentage in the regular season. And from Jackson, Michigan, that's Tony Dungy, Hall of Fame 2016. In the owners category, there's Eddie DiBartolo Jr., who was the owner of the San Francisco 49ers. He's out of Notre Dame, the University of Notre Dame. He purchased the 49ers in 1977. He had a vision to create a top-notch organization, both on and off the field. He's known as a player's owner. He led the franchise to unprecedented winning during tenure. In 1979, he hired Bill Walsh as the team's head coach, drafted quarterback Joe Montana, and created an atmosphere conducive to winning. The fortunes of franchise changed soon after. In 1981, the Niners finished 13-3 to claim the NFC Western Division title and won hard-fought playoff battles with the New York Giants, Dallas Cowboys, and they capped the year with a thrilling 26-21 victory over the Cincinnati Bengals in Super Bowl 16. Got that one. DiBartolo infused a team roster with talent that resulted in San Francisco enjoying an amazing string of winning seasons. The team averaged 13 wins per season, including playoffs, during a span from 1981 to 1988, not including that strike-shortened 1982 season. During Eddie's ownership, the team claimed 13 division titles, made 16 playoffs appearances, and advanced to the NFC Championship game 10 times, and was the first franchise ever to win 5 Super Bowls. The franchise posted the best winning percentage in the NFL in both decades of the 80s and 90s. He was named the NFL Man of the Year by Football News 1989 as the nation's top sports executive. Eddie DiBartolo is also highly respected inside NFL circles and served on the league's realignment and expansion committees. From Youngstown, Ohio, that's Eddie DiBartolo Jr., Hall of Fame 2016. Brett Favre, quarterback out of Southern Mississippi. 1991 Atlanta Falcons, 1992 to 2007 Green Bay Packers, 2008 New York Jets, 2009 to 2010 Minnesota Vikings. 20 seasons, 302 games. Drafted in the second round of the 1991 season draft by the Atlanta Falcons. Traded to Green Bay following the rookie season in which he had 4 pass attempts. Instantly became free-willing passer with the Packers and threw more than 500 passes in 16 seasons. He threw for 3,000 yards in all but his first and last season, recorded 4,000-yard season 6 times. Retired as the NFL's all-time leading passer with 6,300 completions, 10,169 attempts, 71,838 yards, and 508 touchdowns. He threw 4 or more touchdown passes in a then-record 23 games. Established playoff records for attempts, 791, completions, 481, yards, 5,855, and consecutive games with a TD pass, 20. Led NFL in touchdown passes 4 times, including 3 straight seasons. First team All-Pro 3 straight seasons, second team All-Pro twice. All NFC 6 times, selected to 11 Pro Bowls. Named NFL's most valuable player 3 consecutive times, started in 5 NFC championship games, threw a pair of touchdown passes, adding a rushing TD to lead the Packers to Super Bowl victory. He's a member of the NFL's all-decade team of the 90s from Gulfport, Mississippi, quarterback Brett Favre, Hall of Fame class of 2016. Kevin Green, the linebacker and defensive end from Auburn, 1985 to 1992, Los Angeles Rams, 1993 to 1995, Pittsburgh Steelers, 96 and 98 and 99, Carolina Panthers, 1997, San Francisco 49ers. 15 seasons, 228 games. Selected by the Rams in the 5th round in the 1985 draft, played primarily on special teams as a rookie, the only season he didn't register a sack. did not have any starts in the second season, but played all 16 games and managed 7 sacks. Added 6.5 sacks in 1987, and by a fourth season was a bona fide pass rusher for the Rams, registering a career-high 16.5 sacks, including a career-best 4.5 sacks in a win over the 49ers in the season finale that clinched playoff spot for the Rams. The following year, he matched his 16.5 sack total, had double-digit sack totals 10 times, second in the record book at the time. The only time he missed recording 10 sacks in any of the last 8 seasons was 1995, when he had a team-leading 9 sacks for the Steelers. He was named to the Pro Bowl 5 times, once with the Rams, twice with the Steelers and Panthers, selected first-team All-Pro 1989 with the Rams, 1994 with Pittsburgh, and 1996 with Carolina. Captured lead sack total twice, 1995 and 1996. He's a member of the NFL's all-decade team of the 90s, played in 6 consecutive championship games and 1 Super Bowl, led the team in sacks 11 times and amassed 160 total sacks, third all-time at the time of his retirement. He also had 3 safeties, 26 opponent fumble recoveries, and 5 interceptions. From New York, New York, Kevin Green out of Auburn, Hall of Fame 2016. Marvin Harrison, wide receiver from Syracuse, 1996 to 2008, Indianapolis Colts, 13 seasons, 190 games. Selected in the first round in 1996, the Colts obtained a pick in the draft with the Falcons in exchange for quarterback Jeff George. Earned all rookie honors and led the Colts in receptions, receiving yards, and total touchdowns. Had 3 touchdown game against the Chiefs as a rookie. Matched that 3 touchdown effort 8 more times during his career. He had a breakout season in 1999. Teamed with quarterback Peyton Manning, he racked up 115 receptions for league leading 1,663 yards and 12 touchdowns. He had a remarkable string of 8 straight years with 1,000-plus yards receiving, 10 or more touchdowns. Best season may have been 2002, when he shattered NFL single-season record for receptions and had a career-high 1,722 yards and 11 touchdowns. In 2004, he tied career-high for touchdowns in a season with 15. The major factor in the Colts' march to Super Bowl, where the team defeated the Chicago Bears 29-17. He was a member of the NFL's all-decade team of the 2000s, retired following 2008 season with 1,102 career receptions, 14,580 yards, and 129 touchdowns. 8-time Pro Bowl selection, finished second to Jerry Rice in the league annals in career receptions, most consecutive games with a reception, and most career 100-yard gains. The yardage total ranked him 4th all-time, and career touchdowns 9th on the all-time list at the time of his retirement. A 6-time All-Pro, 8-time All-AFC selection, out of Syracuse, the wide receiver Marvin Harrison, Hall of Fame 2016. Orlando Pace, tackle out of The Ohio State University, 1997 to 2008, St. Louis Rams, 2009 Chicago Bears, 13 seasons, 169 games, selected by St. Louis in the first round, the first player overall, the 1997 NFL Draft. He passed up his senior year at Ohio State to enter the NFL draft. The first offensive lineman selected first overall since 1968, a mainstay on the Rams' offensive line, started all 16 games 7 times during his 13-year career, started 165 of 169 games played. He blocked for 3 straight NFL MVPs, quarterback Kurt Warner and running back Marshall Faulk in 2000. He anchored the Rams' offensive line that threw for more gross yards than any other team during his 12 seasons with the team. Ram offenses threw for more than 3,000 yards in each of his 12 seasons with the team. Seven times a Ram quarterback eclipsed the 3,000-yard passing mark, including three surpassing 4,000 yards under his protection. He also blocked for seven 1,000-yard rushers, a seven-time Pro Bowl selection, five-time All-Pro selection. In 2001, he capped off the regular season Pro Bowl play by leading the team to a Super Bowl appearance. In 2000, he anchored an offensive line that helped the offense produce more passing yards in NFL history, most passing yards in NFL history. That's Orlando Pace, the tackle out of The Ohio State University. We don't have time for that, the rundown on too many more. Kenny the Snake Stabler out of Alabama, quarterback for the Oakland Raiders, made it to the Hall of Fame. And Dick Stanfell, a guard out of San Francisco, played for the Lions and the Redskins, made it into Canton. That was the selection committee's choices for 2016. And that should just about do it for the Sports Talk 1240 tonight. I'd like to thank my guests, Mark Farner, Butch Trucks, and Tom Pody. I'd like to thank my engineer, Brian Graves. And most of all, I thank you for joining us. I'll be back with you next Sunday, February 14th at 8, with former Islanders Stanley Cup-winning defenseman Bob Lorimer and former Mets pitcher Vic Black. Till then, Bill Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks.
Program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.